Alrighty, 1 Samuel chapter 10 tonight. 1 Samuel. I know we're in Samuel in Wednesday night, but First Samuel 10. Now, Israel has requested for herself a king, and when the Lord was her king, so there's going to be backlash from that. Samuel has gone through and told them something of the type of king that they were going to get. I suppose that was the Lord's foreknowledge speaking to them. And so as this works out, Saul, of course, gets in the presence of Samuel, and in chapter 10, verse 1, and then Samuel took a vial of oil, poured it upon his head, and kissed him, and said, "Is it not because the Lord hath anointed thee to be captain over his inheritance? When thou art departed from me today, thou shalt find two men by Rachel's sepulcher in the border of Benjamin at Zelzah, and they will say unto thee, the asses which thou wentest to seek are found, and lo, thy father hath left the care of the asses, and sorroweth for you, saying, what shall I do for my son? Then shalt thou go on forward from thence, and thou shalt come to the plain of Tabor, and there shall meet thee three men going up to God to Bethel, one carrying three kids, and another carrying three loaves of bread, another carrying a bottle of wine. They will salute thee and give thee two loaves of bread, which thou shalt receive of thy hands. After that thou shalt come to the hill of God, which is where is the garrison of the Philistines. And it shall come to pass, when thou art come thither to the city, that thou shalt meet a company of prophets coming down from the high place with a psaltery and a tabret and a pipe and a harp before them, and they shall prophesy. And the Spirit of the Lord will come upon thee, and thou shalt prophesy with them, and thou shalt be turned into another man." By the way, that is not the new birth, just so you know. But verse 7, "And let it be, when these signs are come unto thee, that thou do as occasion serve thee, for God is with thee." And so a lot of other things happen, but I'll stop there in verse 7. Let's go ahead and pray. Now, Lord, come to you tonight and ask you to plead to please wash me in the blood and help the thoughts of my heart to be clear enough to be able to put across to these folks. Saw a couple of things in here in the passage this week, and I just wanted to bring them out here for a while tonight. I pray that you might just please bless it, Lord, and we pray as we seek God's will, Lord, that you would supply our questions with answers. And we pray these things in Jesus' name. Amen. So, I've just finished reading 1st or 2nd Samuel, and so I was coming through here recently, and, reading through Saul's life is like watching, kind of watching a slow train wreck, and you know a few of those I know in your own life, and I'll say that I would have hated to have inherited Saul's portion and lot in life, his circumstances. Who wants to be made a king when God didn't really want you, but everybody else wanted you, And so he's kind of set up for a fall to start with. It's an unenviable position. Samuel foretold some of his failings a little bit earlier than chapter 10, and he started out with a couple of strikes against him, as you know, but it's also worth saying that Saul didn't do himself any favors. The fact of the matter is he stoked the boiler and ran the train off the tracks. And so, acknowledging all that, I just point out to us that we're saints in the last days and the latter times. And in the latter times, perilous times shall come. These are perilous times. We all trend towards certain things. We are Laodicean Christians. We live in Laodicea, and so we are Laodicean Christians. We should labor to be the exceptions, but just the same, there are trends and proclivities that we have, and not the least of which is a bankruptcy of character. Evil men and seducers shall wax worse and worse, deceiving and being deceived. As everybody goes south around us, it's hard sometimes to go ahead and put in the hard labor to mold and engrave the kind of character we're supposed to have. So I say all that to simply say this. We live during a great time of falling away. And so this is not an in-depth study of Saul's apostasy. What I came away with from reading this time through this path, through these chapters, is just a couple of things, two or three things that really clicked with me that I felt like I wanted to make sure and bring out, and just some practical stuff that I know some people struggle with. I don't even necessarily say anybody here as such, but some things that have shored up kind of helped stop the slide. And so let me talk to you just in general about kind of some loose-fitted things here, some lessons from Saul's life. And like I said, I'm not trying to, delineate each and everything that Saul did wrong or anything like that. But the first thing that really struck me this time, going through 1 Samuel and reading through Saul's life, was this portion that we just read. And in verse 7, it says an interesting thing. And, you know, there have been some times that folks have come to me in the past wrestling with the will of God and what they should do, and they've been praying and fasting and fasting and can't seem to get any answers, and they don't know whether it's a Miracle Whip or mayo, and they just want to know what God wants from them. You know, one of those deals. And just really, and they just really obsess with it. I've noticed that once somebody gets right, and a lot of times it happens with young men. I've seen that in some guys that were seeking the will of God, and, you know, they go to Bible school or whatever, and they really want to, you know, they really want the right girl to marry. They really want the right field to go through. They want to wind up in the right place and all that. And they wind up kind of obsessing about the will of God, because there was a time when they didn't want the will of God at all. And so, you know, that's where we all were. And so we didn't care about the will of God. So one day we found out that God had a plan for our lives, and then we want to know the details. And so then you have a tendency to want to kind of obsess about some details. And you want so much for God to speak to you, write some letters in the backyard so you'll know what He wants you to do. And you're willing to play the fleece game a little bit and just pray that the God answers them, you know, those sort of things. And I wish I had picked up on this earlier. I would have been probably a better counselor. But just regarding, first lesson regarding the vagueness in the will of God at times that folks experience. Like I said, sometimes it happens in ladies too, but young men, guys, you know, they find the will of God. They know God has a plan for their life. They go to school or they don't go to school, but they really, really know what the Lord wants them to do. And so they really, really are praying. They're really, really fasting. They go into a revival meeting, and they are praying that God speaks to them in this meeting. And the problem is, sometimes in the same sermon, they're both encouraged and distraught, because part of what the guy said, oh yeah, that shows me something. And then the rest of what the guy said, oh, he shot me down. You know, kind of one of those deals. So you become kind of shell-shocked with trying to figure things out. Like I said, it almost becomes a Miracle Whip versus, you know, mayo type deal. Ford or Chevy. You don't know what to do. And sometimes, you know, I've seen guys go through a really hard time. I mean, you know, am I supposed to date this girl? Are we supposed to allow it to go further? You know, you start fretting specifics that, you know, maybe the Lord is not all that interested in at this point. I'm saying this within the context and with the bounds of doing right. You know, we're not talking about committing adultery. We're not talking about gambling. But we're talking about just somebody who wants to do right, who just really, really wants God to shine light on the next step, and somehow the Lord just kind of seems to leave them hanging, and they get mixed messages out of messages they hear. And sometimes they're encouraged, sometimes they're discouraged. They're just on the edge all the time. And I got some light on that. It regards vagueness in the will of God. Again, I wish I had picked up on this earlier in life a little bit, because I could have used it myself some. I was kind of a head case for a while. I'd like to point out just a trend here that you see in Saul. And maybe Saul is a weird guy to find these things in. I know he's not the best example in the world, but still God was working in his life. And I'd like you to see and go back to chapter 9, if you would. And this is how the Lord starts with most of us at one time or another. And it's the providential part. It's where God shows up in your life in a miraculous way, and somebody comes to your door that has light, or you run into somebody and somebody hands you a tract or some such thing like that, and the Lord kind of works providentially in your behalf. It happened to me when I was coming out of my backslidden years in high school and college, and I was seeking the truth, and I just stumbled into a Sunday school class where this, in a Southern Baptist church of all things, where this guy was teaching Dr. Ruckman's material in a Southern Baptist Sunday school. And I mean, they found him out after 2 or 3 months and kicked him out, but by then I'd been ruined, you know. But just to stumble into some old big old church where you have to go across the street to go into a strip mall for a temporary Sunday school scenarios, and you walk in there and this guy is teaching Dr. Ruckman stuff, and it's like, whoa, never heard anything like that. You're just ruined, man. And so it's stuff like that that I'm talking about. I had nothing to do with that, right? Okay, notice here in 1 Samuel chapter 9 and going down to verse 3, and the asses of Kish, Saul's father, were lost. And Kish said to Saul, his son, take now one of the servants with thee and rise and go seek the asses. And so they go looking for the donkeys. And you know, in the process of time through chapter 9 and so on, they find the donkeys, and the servant makes a suggestion, let's go talk to the seer, Samuel, and maybe he can help us out. And I mean, they've been dealing with this issue in the greater kingdom about finding a king, and the Lord wanted David as king to be the first king, I'm sure of that, but instead, Israel now wants a king, and so they're going to get a king. And so here's Samuel praying, and here comes Saul down the road, looking for donkeys, and shows up, and I mean, this is the guy, this is the king. He's taller than anybody else, he's a goodly person. There's not a taller man in Israel, he's just a really kingly looking dude. And that's the one God chose. And so I want to just say to start with, there's first of all, and most times in the will of God, there's that providential part where even like the Lord allows you to be born into a family where your mother and father are Bible believers and you get stuck in the right church right away. That's providential. Or you're standing somewhere on a street corner, you hear somebody hollering, and you wind up getting saved because of their shouting and screaming, and you wind up coming out of Roman Catholicism or some such thing into the right church. Strolling, crawling, whatever, streaming, searching, whatever, on YouTube, and stumble upon Gene Kim, and Gene Kim says, go to a good Bible believing church near you, you look it up and here's one. And so you go. That kind of deal. But that's the providential part. It's the part that you really don't have a lot to do with. It's God showing up and doing something special for you. You know what I'm saying? So that's the first step. And there's this. Then you get down to chapter 10, verse 1. Saul gets in Samuel's presence, and Samuel took a vial of oil and poured it upon his hand and kissed him and said, it's got to be weird. You got this old seer, starting pouring oil and smacking you and kissing you and stuff. It's like weird, Well, this is where Samuel delivers to Saul specific instructions, tells him he's going to be king, and Saul has a hard time absorbing it all and all that. But that's the definitive part. That's where, it's no longer just providential. It's not God by chances and so on and so forth, just by circumstances directing you, showing up on your front doorstep. He has now given you a Bible. He's now given you promises. And from now on, you're supposed to follow those promises and follow these instructions and these commandments. Okay? That's the definitive part. And that's being given orders. That's being given definitive instructions. And so, Samuel gives him some of those. But then there's this. Then you get down to chapter 10, verse 6. And the Lord's worked in your life, and so you've made contact, and you're now on the right road. And then the Lord gave you the Bible and gave you instruction. And then He gave you light. And so now you can walk on the road and not go into the ditch. And then it says, and the Spirit of the Lord will come upon thee, and thou shalt prophesy with them, and shalt be turned into another man. Let it be when these signs are come unto thee, that thou do as occasion serve thee, for God is with thee. And for somebody that's seeking, for somebody that's found the Lord, they're saved, they're in the right church, God's done a work to get them where they're supposed to be. And he's given them the Bible, and he's discipled them some, and he's given them, you know, some definitive commands and some definitive things. Now you have to make up your own mind. Now you're going to have to decide, you know, Mayo or Miracle Whip, Chevy or Ford. Now you're going to have to pray about, you know, whether you should date this girl or that girl, or whether you should go out with this guy. You know, those sort of things, the kind of things that you would like for the Lord to say, I want you to marry him, you know. And it just doesn't often happen that way. Well, here is Saul, and he's been anointed, and he's going to be anointed king later on in this chapter. And Samuel's instructions to him were, let it be when these signs are come unto thee, verse 7, that thou do as occasion serve thee. And for somebody struggling with some stuff along those lines of the not-so-definitive will of God, you know, you're going to need to pray and figure out what's right and what's wrong. That's for sure. You have a Bible for that. And you're going to have to, you know, wrestle with whether you're called to preach or called to be a missionary or whether you should take the Sunday school class or whatever, or something like that. But in general, the Lord apparently grants liberty for you to do as occasion serve thee. That's the instruction that he gave Paul. In other words, well, I just don't know if God wants me to go on a mission trip. Oh, God, please show me. Please tell me. Please help me. Do you want me to go on the mission trip? And nothing happens. Okay, well, if you have the money to go, and you want to go, and you pray the Lord stops you if he doesn't want you to go, do as occasion serve thee. In a way, you know, it's not do what you want to do, but if you have opportunity and you're of a mind to do it, then go. And there's a thousand things like that. I mean, well, you know, some kid, I say kids, I don't mean to be derogatory, but they kind of obsess and kind of freak out. I don't, you know, I've seen so many people, you know, whose marriages end, and, you know, I just want the Lord to send the right girl along. So, you know, I don't know if I should go out with her or not, because I don't know what she's like. I don't know about her. And so you kind of obsess on it. Well, take her out for a hamburger and find out if you like her. And if you like her and she likes you and she loves God and she's saved and y'all aren't doing wrong, you say, well, should I go out with her again or not? Oh, I just don't know. Oh, God, show me. Well, do as occasion serve thee. I'm just saying, I'm not trying to lower the bar on anything. I'm not trying to denigrate the necessity of prayer and of seeking God's will, God's perfect will. But there are just some things along the way. I don't know that God's will is between these rock-hard walls where it's about this wide. And boy, if you step off, he's going to drop a boulder on your head. I mean, it seems to me that that's what liberty kind of is, and latitude. We're not given license to do some things. I'm not talking about doing wrong, but I am talking about you having the Lord allowing an opportunity to come, and the girl's pretty, you like her, you think she might be fun to go out with, and who knows what will happen. Well, see if she'll go out with you. And if you like her, well, she say, well, go out with her again. Do as occasion serve thee. Don't exploit it, but quit looking for the Lord. I mean, quit going through the stomach-churning, acid-producing process of each and every little thing, obsessing on every little detail of what you're supposed to do. Because you can kind of drive yourself nuts with that. When we started the ministry, I kind of drove myself crazy a little bit because I just, oh God, I just want to preach what you want me to preach. So God, show me. And so I'm sitting home at 5 o'clock on a Sunday afternoon and pretty soon you have to go into a scramble mode, you know, to pull something together, and you don't even care anymore if God's in it or not. You just don't want to be an idiot and stand up and say nothing. Okay, well, so I learned to to read my Bible and have some ideas, you know, and, you know, it's still hard work and I still see the Lord's hand doing stuff and all those things, but, you know, by Thursday and Friday I need to start having an idea or else I start getting nervous, you know, and it doesn't have to be that God, you know, throws bricks from the sky with messages on them or anything like that, but it's simply the fact that, you know, there's a part of it that you're a part of. You have decisions to make, and you have to make decisions to serve God in certain ways. And if the Lord stops you from doing that, then shut her down and don't go that way. But in the meantime, you ought not feel like you're about to be executed if, you know, you don't get fire written in the heavens for you. Serve as occasion serve thee. Serve God as occasion serve thee. That's how he said that. Do as occasion serve thee. Now, if the will of God, the will of God ought not to be a prison. I mean, that's what it becomes for some. They become so anxious and so stressed out about it that every little thing just has to be, you know, God's direction. I got news for you. You're called to walk by faith and not by sight. And so there's some things you're just going to have to choose. And you'll get to largely choose after you say, Lord, I'd like to buy that Chevy, and he shuts her down, drops a piano on her, then go buy the Ford. Amen. But aside from that, Mayo, Miracle Whip, nobody cares except the other people that like the other thing. And whether or not you should date her or whatever, you know, do as occasion serve thee. Know what I'm saying? Now, stepping a little beyond that, I mean, Saul, I just wanted to show you here. Look over in chapter 14. I know I'm skipping some stuff, but, you know, Saul is told to do as occasion serves him, and he has a couple of battles that he fights with some enemies, and he does very well. But as things fall apart in his life, well, look how arbitrary and petty he got. Look down in chapter 14, verse 24. And the men of Israel were distressed that day, for Saul had adjured the people, saying, "Cursed be the man that eateth any food until evening, that I may be avenged on mine enemies." He's taken an army to battle and forbidden them to eat. Is that smart? No, that's a guy pressing for a decision. That's a guy doing stupid stuff and making nonsensical decisions and almost ruining the army because of it. There's a little more down in chapter 14, verse 38. And Saul wants God to tell him what to do. And the Lord, in verse 37, answered him not that day. And Saul said, "Draw ye near hither, all the chief of the people." And they wind up drawing lots. And he's already determined, already says, whoever draws the lot, I'm going to kill them because they're the problem. And so the lot falls on Jonathan. This is a guy making stupid, arbitrary decisions. And so I'm advising, if you don't do as occasion serve thee, God is not going to direct every little thing. And so if you're not careful, you may wind up making bad decisions. Here is Saul, by the time he gets over to chapter 15, he commits rebellion and disobedience, doesn't kill Agag, and so on and so forth. You say, what's the point? The point is, sometimes it's acknowledged there's a vagueness in the will of God. And in times of that vagueness, my admonishment would be within the bounds of what's right, within the bounds of what the Bible says, do as occasion serve thee. All right? That's the first thing I got out of it. Now look in chapter 12. Look in chapter 12. Backtrack just a little bit. We're a little past chapter 10 now. And the next thing that stuck out to me with regard to going through Saul this time around, let me start reading in verse 20. And Samuel is dealing with Israel once again. Saul has been anointed, and Saul is king. And Samuel takes one more crack at making sure the people understand what they have done in rejecting God as their king and asking for another king, who is now Saul. And so he goes ahead and does this, verse 20. And Samuel said unto the people, "Fear not, ye have done all this wickedness, yet turn not aside from following the Lord, but serve the Lord with all your heart. And turn ye not aside, for then should ye go after vain things which cannot profit nor deliver, for they are vain. And the Lord will not forsake his people for his great name's sake, because it hath pleased the Lord to make you his people. Moreover, as for God, as for me, God forbid that I should sin against the Lord in ceasing to pray for you, but I will teach you the good and the right way. Only fear the Lord, serve him in truth with all your heart, in light of you asking a king. And now I've given him to you, and now you know there's a dark aspect to this. Only fear the Lord, serve him in truth with all your heart, for consider how great things he hath done for you. But if ye shall do wickedly, ye shall be consumed, both ye and your king. Now, with that being stated, the next thing that stuck out to me, and like I said, these don't all go together real great, but this regards the value of a righteous culture. And don't take culture to mean some commie-lib thing. But the value of a righteous culture. Saul is his own worst enemy. He is stoking the boiler. He's going to drive the train off the cliff. And he couldn't blame anybody else for the mistakes that he made and where he wound up. But Samuel still said what he said to Israel. And what he said to Israel was, verse 24, only fear the Lord, serve him in truth with all your heart, for consider how great things he hath done for you. But if you shall do wickedly, ye shall be consumed, both ye and your king. And what I'm trying to say there is that the people of Israel had a role to play in Saul staying right. I don't mean that Saul didn't, you know, cut off the limb that he was sitting on in his own right and shot himself in the foot, but Israel in the end made it easier for Saul to fall and to go the direction that he went. Israel had this continuing problem with idols, and they always were on a roller coaster. They were always hot, then cold. They were always up, then down. They were always with God, then they were with idols the next week. It just went round and round and round and round throughout their entire history. And so the Lord's saying, now look here, if you will serve God, then your king will have a better chance of being the king he's supposed to be. And if you do wrong, then your king's probably going to do wrong too. And so, I know, look, everybody knows examples of prodigal sons and daughters that, you know, come from really good, really solid families. And everybody knows some guy that went apostate and backslidden even though he was in a good church. Those sort of things, I know those things happen. But Israel's history was a roller coaster, and they didn't do much to fortify their king. All I'm saying here, folks, is that there's a lesson to be learned about the value of a righteous culture. By that I mean a saint still benefits from a family where their mother and the father are both engaged and both reading their Bible and both praying. And when mama's doing good, daddy's not necessarily doing bad. And when daddy's doing good, mama's not necessarily doing bad. They're not always fighting each other. And dad isn't just a check-in, check-out type Christian. I mean, he's at the head of his home. He's praying himself. He's reading himself. He's trying to love his wife and trying to do things right. He's trying to lead his kids the right way. There's just an awful lot of fathers that check out. And then they wonder why things go awry. Oh, we raised them in a Christian family. We never did get drunk or anything like that. And look, off they go. What kind of thankfulness is that? Well, were you consistent? Were you solid? Were you what you were supposed to be? I know we all fail in being all that we're supposed to be, but I'm simply saying that a saint still benefits, a kid still benefits, when his mother and father are both engaged and doing right. It doesn't guarantee that he's going to do right. But he has a better chance of doing right if y'all are doing right. And Saul had a better chance of doing right if Israel did right. And Israel didn't do the greatest at that. And so I'm not blaming them for Saul. And Saul shouldn't blame them either, so because Saul was his own worst enemy. But the fact of the matter is, a Christian has a better chance of catching himself and being what he's supposed to be if he's in a good church where the pulpit's hot and folks get challenged and folks get fed and all those things. It doesn't guarantee that everybody here is going to go on and go upward, but it is the fact that you have a better chance with a righteous culture here than if you don't have a righteous culture and you're in some mega church, coochie-coochie place. A saint still benefits from a circle of friends that are serious about serving the Lord. It doesn't mean that he's not going to go awry. It doesn't guarantee anything. There are no guarantees. But he has a better chance of catching himself with a circle of good friends than a circle of bad ones. Once in a while, somebody comes out of a circle of bad friends or out of a bad church or out of a bad family and is the exception. But that's really not the ground you want to plant in, right? What's the point? The point is there's a value to a righteous culture. You know, me and Dave and Jeff and us guys, and our wives, we are the boomer generation, the boomers. And then the generation that followed us in the late 60s, born in the late 60s and into the 70s and early 80s, are Generation X. That's the generation before the millennials. And one thing that you now look at in the country, I'm not trying to be an old codger about this, but for those of us that were boomers and maybe even Generation Xers, there was still a streak in the U.S. where hard work, discipline, character was appreciated. I don't know that that's there anymore for whatever this generation Z, AA, Q, queer, LGBT, whatever they are these days. I'm serious. I don't envy teenagers or kids because they're growing up in a generation where, you know, if you don't get it here and at home, you're not even going to catch a sniff of it out there. My wife is at the Casey's across from Anoka High School the other day, filling up with gas just as school was letting out. She came home, she goes, "There are some weird kids crossing the street." She said, "It was a little scary." Scary? Kids crossing the street at a gas station? It's scary? I guess so. She's going to start carrying a gun, I guess. I don't know. But that's the thing is, you know, there was a day that in America there was still this broad streak of character and discipline and hard work, and if it wasn't exactly righteous, I know it wasn't righteous because there were still the roaring 20s and the awful 30s or whatever those were. I know that America's been ungodly for a long time, but there was still this broad streak in America where there were people that believed in the main, even lost people, in certain right things. I don't even know where you go to find it anymore. Go ahead and sit down on a college campus and you ain't going to find it there. And apparently not in the high schools either. Nicely not the one that she was filling up across from. But my point is just the value of a righteous culture. Israel doing right would have given Saul at least more of a chance of recovering himself. But it didn't happen. All right, there's something else I'd have you see here. Look in chapter 10. Go back to chapter 10 and verse 8. And people don't like to wait. Speaking of the generation we live in, boy, convenience is everything. And the immediacy, the instantness of things. And, you know, it's been a major, you know, it's been a major adjustment because now McDonald's and Burger King are, you know, undermanned, and so sometimes you have to sit in line for 4 minutes to get a Big Mac. It's hard. I mean, it's really hard. Right? Because people have this instant mindset. Okay, and so if you're not careful, you think that's the way it should be with God. Look in chapter 10, verse 8. Now, we started in 10:7. That was the issue about the vagueness of the will of God at times. In verse 8, "And thou shalt go down before me to Gilgal, and behold, I will come down unto thee to offer burnt sacrifices, burnt offerings, and to sacrifice sacrifices of burnt peace offerings. 7 days shalt thou tarry till I come to thee and show thee what thou shalt do. So don't start without me. I'm coming. Wait 7 days. Don't start without me, because then I got to show you what you're going to do." Right? Go down over to chapter 13. Chapter 13. And I don't know if I want to read the whole passage, but in verse 1, Saul reigned 1 year, and after he'd reigned 2 years over Israel, by the way, all the new versions mess that verse up. You should just go see what they put there. Just go run through, you know, a few versions, and you'll come out with your eyes crossed. It's just weird. Anyway, but he says after he's reigned 2 years, some things happen. In verse 4, "And Israel heard say that Saul had smitten the garrison of the Philistines, and that Israel also had an abomination with the Philistines, and the people were called together after Saul to Gilgal." That's the town that Samuel said, "Make sure and you wait 7 days." Well, Saul goes in there, and the Philistines start making a bunch of noise of war, and so everybody's getting nervous. In verse 8, "And he tarried 7 days according to the time set that Samuel had appointed. But Samuel came not to Gilgal, and the people were scattered from him. And Saul said, Bring hither a burnt offering to me and peace offerings. And he offered the burnt offering. And it came to pass that as soon as he had made an end of offering the burnt offering, behold, Samuel came, and Saul went out to meet him, that he might..." So, I mean, Saul had no more gotten the fire started, and the burnt offering burnt, and up the hill came Samuel like a tornado, man. Verse 11. "And Samuel said, What hast thou done? And Saul said, Because I saw that the people were scattered from me, and that thou camest not within the days appointed, and that the Philistines gathered themselves together at Michmash. Therefore said I, The Philistines will come down now upon me to Gilgal, and I have not made supplications unto the Lord. I forced myself, therefore, and offered a burnt offering." All right. Did you notice that what Saul did, he just didn't wait? And you know, to this point, it's funny, because to this point, Saul has done nothing wrong. To this point in the past, you've been warned, Samuel warned Israel that the nature of this king is not going to be good, but so far, Saul has won a battle or two, and there's been nothing awry, there's been nothing wrong. Saul's first step in starting down the grease slide was not waiting. Everything hinged on Saul waiting. And there's a little more there, because this is the time that you read where in verse 14, "But now thy kingdom shall not continue. The Lord hath sought him a man after his own heart." Well, we all know who that is. That's David. David was the man after God's own heart, right? He says, "You're not the guy, because I'm looking for a guy that's a man after God's own heart." Well, by proxy, that means the man after God's own heart would have waited. He would have waited. This was the first step that Saul took down the grease slide, and it was not waiting. You know what that's called? That's called haste. And so this regards the validity of waiting on the Lord. The vagueness of the will of God, the value of a righteous culture, the validity of waiting on the Lord. This began the slide. The man after God's own heart would have waited. Think how long David waited after he was anointed king that day when Saul came to his house and all the other brothers were run through, and he came up and he says, "That's the guy," and he anointed him. It was a lot of years between then and when David took the throne and became the king of Israel. There was a long period of waiting. But the man of God's own, after God's own heart, did wait. Now, ladies and gentlemen, if there's never been a day, this is the day. People are itchy. people's trigger fingers just twitch all the time. They're impulsive, they're impetuous, and they're hasty. And some of you are making decisions like that. I don't have anybody in mind, don't worry. But I know people and they make hasty decisions. You're flirting with disaster. I'm not saying you need letters written in the sky. I'm not saying that you can't do as occasion serveth thee. I've just preached about that. I'm saying you shouldn't just rush in haste to make a decision. You need convincing. Look in Proverbs real quick. Just do a quick little run through Proverbs. Keep a finger in 1 Samuel. Let me just show you real quickly and just sum it up real fast how damaging this can be. Proverbs chapter 14. You live in a hasty day because you want it now. Proverbs chapter 14, go down to verse 29. 14, 29. He that is slow to wrath is of great understanding, but he that is hasty of spirit, a general characteristic, he that is hasty of spirit exalteth folly. Now, we're going to do something else, but just note that that verse mentioned being slow to wrath. Just keep that in the back of your mind for a minute. But he that is hasty of spirit exalteth folly. If you're making decisions fast, and I don't mean that there's never a time to make an instant decision, because sometimes there is. If you're going to save the baby from the train, then you've got to go snatch the baby. Right? But there's not that many times that the Lord makes you, it presents you with a situation right now and you have to make a decision right now, go or no. There's just not that many times. Now, flee idolatry, flee youthful lust, all those things, but as far as, you know, Chevy or Ford, decide right now. You don't have to. You can pray first. You don't have to run there. You don't have to spend $30,000 right now. Not this moment. I mean, I would suggest you pray before you spend $30,000. Right? Especially if it becomes a habit. Thank you very much. But there are folks that are hasty of spirit. Look in Proverbs 19. Proverbs 19. Talking here about haste. This point is regarding the validity of waiting on God. You're urged over and over again to wait on the Lord. Okay? You wait in prayer. You wait for answers. But you're supposed to wait on God. 19:2. Also that the soul be without knowledge, it is not good. And he that hasteth with his feet sinneth. The faster you run, the quicker you make decisions, and you know, the more likely you are to mess stuff up. Look in chapter 21. 21. Verse 5. The thoughts of the diligent tend only to plenteousness, but of everyone that is hasty, only to want. Your family doesn't need that. For your hasty decisions to drive them to have want, that is need, legitimate need of something else. Your family doesn't need that. Look in 28. 28, 20. A faithful man shall abound with blessings, but he that maketh haste to be rich shall not be innocent. To have respect of persons is not good, but for a piece of bread that man will transgress. He that hasteth to be rich hath an evil eye, and considereth not that poverty shall come upon him. There are some things you not should not haste to. You shouldn't be hasty to wrath. You shouldn't be hasty in decisions. Look in 29:20. We're almost done with this. 29:20. Seest thou a man that is hasty in his words? There is more hope of a fool than of him. Now, remember I said to cling to a thought about being slow to something? Look in Proverbs chapter 16. I just have a verse for you. 16:32. Now, I know that sometimes folks get stuck and, you know, a decision needs to be made and you want God to write something in the sky. Well, listen, do as occasion serve thee, but just don't run off over the cliff every time, you know, an opportunity is presented. I mean, you don't really have to spend that money today. The thing at Walmart that you want to buy is probably going to be there tomorrow. You know what I'm saying? There's just a ton of stuff. There are people that people are really hasty. They're really impetuous. They're really quick. They're quick to fall in love. They're quick to get married. They're quick to get the cart before the horse. And man, once that stuff starts, you don't just go back and correct it. There's some things that once you cross the threshold, it's just not an easy fix. Okay, one more. 16:32. He that is slow to anger is better than the mighty. This is the important part, now that we mentioned slow. And he that ruleth his spirit than he that taketh a city. A hasty man does not rule his spirit. He has something presented to him and he goes chasing it. And that's not a good sign. So, vagueness in the will of God. We learned a lesson about that. Do as occasion serve thee within bounds. Regarding the value of a righteous culture, you're better off surrounded by righteous things, righteous people. You're better off with a righteous family. You're better off with a church that's right than out of it. And folks are awfully quick to throw those things away these days. And regarding the validity of waiting on the Lord, now there's this. Look in chapter 15 of 1 Samuel. We've just got a couple more to hit here real quick. 1 Samuel. For some reason, these things kind of jumped off the page at me reading through Saul's life this last time. 1 Samuel chapter 15, go down to verse 17. Now, this chapter is where the Lord, Samuel commands Saul to go and smite Amalek and to utterly destroy Amalek, all his men and all of his goods, you know, everything that's alive. And what do they do? Verse 9. But Saul and the people spared Agag and the best of the sheep and of the oxen and of the fatlings and the lambs and all that was good and would not utterly destroy them. Okay, so they didn't obey. All right? And so Samuel comes and confronts Saul. And Saul is insistent at first, just typical. Verse 13, I have performed the commandment of the Lord. And Samuel said, what meaneth then the bleating of the sheep in mine ears and the lowing of the oxen which I hear? You followed my will, did you? You killed everything, huh? Well, how come I hear sheep bleating and oxen lowing? What was that, your mother-in-law? Right? Okay, so you didn't obey. And so it goes on down, and I mean, Samuel balls up on Saul, and this is how he sums up Saul's problem. Now, by this time, Saul has already messed up and hasn't waited on God. Well, now he has disobeyed, and notice what Samuel says is true of that. And verse 17, and Samuel said, when thou wast little in thine own sight, wast thou not made the head of the tribes of Israel, and the Lord anointed thee king over Israel? I mean, at first, Saul was humble enough and low enough in his own sight. He didn't want to be king. He didn't want the position. And now, you're going to have to pry it out of his dead fingers because he's clutching it, you know? What is that? When thou wast little in thine own sight, verse 17, that is the sure, certain shipwreck of vainglory. The vagueness of the will of God, the value of a righteous culture, the validity of waiting on God, and the sure shipwreck of vainglory. When you start down the road of vanity and glorying in yourself and thinking highly of yourself according to the Bible, you start down the wrong track. And Saul has already taken one step onto the slide that was greased, and now he's got the other foot on it, and he's going to go because of the sure what did I say, the sure shipwreck of vainglory. Look in chapter 18, verse 7. Become so self-consumed. Would you say that we're a self-consumed generation? I mean, everybody's, how many selfies does the average millennial and Generation Y or whatever they are now, how many selfies do they take of themselves a year? Hundreds? Thousands? Walk down the street all the time. You know? Some backdrop, some clown, some horse, something, you know, in the background. What in the world? It's vainglory. It's thinking of self all the time. It's crazy. All right, chapter 18, go down to verse 7. And so Saul starts, you know, manifesting these characteristics. So he's too chicken himself to go out to battle with Goliath. So David goes and defeats Goliath. And now in the parade of celebration, chapter 18, verse 7, and the women answered one another as they played and said, Saul slain his thousands and David his 10,000s. And Saul was very... Look, it's a stupid song. It probably rhymes in Hebrew or something. It's a stupid song. And Saul is torqued off. He says, he was very wroth and the saying displeased him. And he said, they have ascribed unto David 10,000s. And as to me, they have ascribed but thousands. And what can he have more but the kingdom? And Saul eyed David from that day forward. From then on, he didn't trust David. That's a man consumed with himself. It's vainglorious. It's a vanity. Look in chapter 18, verse 12. And Saul was afraid of David because the Lord was with him and was departed from Saul. So it goes deeper and deeper. Verse 28, 18, 28. And Saul saw and knew that the Lord was with David, and that Michal, Saul's daughter, loved him, and Saul was yet the more afraid of David, and Saul became David's enemy continually. You know how all this plays out. Go over to chapter 22. And Saul continues on this self-destructive path where all that matters is him. And finally, David has run off to the cave of Adullam, and he's run him out, and Saul, and David's on the run, and Saul is sitting under his tree whining. He's whining to his men. Look in verse 8. We'll start with verse 7. Then Saul said unto his servants and that stood about him, hear now, ye Benjamites, will the son of Jesse give every one of you fields and vineyards and make you all captains of thousands and captains of hundreds? For all of you have conspired against me, and there is none that showeth me that my son hath made a league with the son of Jesse. There is none of you that is sorry for me or showeth unto me that my son hath stirred up my servant against me to lie in wait at this day. Me, 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 my, my. Sounds like some junior high school twit female in public school today. Me, 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 my. Is my eyeliner okay? Me, me, me. My. But it's regarding the sure shipwreck of vainglory. Saul started down the path, and once it becomes all about you, the game is over. The devil's got you, and one day he's going to crash you and ruin you. It's just that way. Look in 22:13. And so, sure enough, in the midst of all this, you know, David has to run and get some help from Abimelech, which we covered on Wednesday night here a while back. And the king, verse 11, sent to Abimelech, the priest, and the son of Ahitub and all his father's house, and the priests that were in Nob, and they came, all of them, to the king. And Saul said, hear now, thou son of Ahitub. And he answered, here am I, my lord. And Saul said unto him, why have ye conspired against me, that the son of Jesse, and that thou hast given him bread and a sword, and hast inquired of the Lord of God for him, that he should rise against me to lie in wait as this day? He's blaming. He winds up having Ahimelech killed. He winds up having his own high priest killed. He's consumed with it. He's consumed with himself. And so we have a day that we live in. men shall be lovers of their own selves. It's such a innocent few words. Men shall be lovers of their own selves. It just seems so innocent. It just doesn't seem that big a deal. But that is the earmark of our generation, where men can't think of anything but themselves. In their marriages, they only think of themselves. In their families, they only think of themselves. Sometimes in their own churches, they only think of themselves. If there's ever trouble here, it will largely be because somebody's thinking of themselves. Yeah. Yeah. It's vainglorious. And it is a certain shipwreck waiting to happen. So, the vagueness of the will of God. Validity of waiting on God, on the Lord. The value of a righteous culture. The sure shipwreck of vainglory. There's one last thing, and we'll be short enough. Chapter 16. Chapter 16 and verse 17. Roll back a little bit in Saul's life, and by this time, David's been anointed, and upon David's anointing, the Lord dispatched an evil spirit, as you know, to trouble Saul. And so Saul gets real cranky when he's under the effects of the evil spirit. And so verse 17, and Saul said unto his servants, provide me now a man that can play well and bring him to me. Then answered one of the servants and said, behold, I have seen a son of Jesse the Bethlehemite that is cunning in playing, and a mighty valiant man, and a man of war, and prudent in matters, and a comely person, and the Lord is with him. Wherefore Saul sent messengers unto Jesse and said, send me David thy son, which is with the sheep. And Jesse took an ass laden with bread and a bottle of wine and a kid, and sent them by David his son unto Saul. And David came to Saul and stood before him, and he loved him greatly, and he became his armor bearer. And Saul sent to Jesse, saying, let David, I pray thee, stand before me, for he hath found favor in my sight. And it came to pass, when the evil spirit from God was upon Saul, that David took an harp and played with his hand. So Saul was refreshed and was well, and the evil spirit departed from him. Now, I know it's a small, relatively small thing, and I know you don't see an awful lot of evidence of it in Saul's life, but if those verses are true, then one of the lessons that you should learn from Saul's life is regarding the benefits of virtuous things. In this case, the way out, temporarily at least, for Saul to have some relief from the evil spirit was David coming and playing music. Now listen, David wasn't playing boogie-woogie, and he wasn't playing, rhythm and blues. He was playing pure music. You know the kind of music that David played. It's the kind of music that went along with the songs that he sang. Okay, so I would just want to just put forth to you here that there should be, for me and you, in this day, with the effects of David's music on Saul, you should acknowledge the benefit of virtuous things. I'm not going to get stuck on music, but I would just urge you that the music of this world is not going to be much help to your spirit. And there's plenty of pure music out there if you'll go searching for it. And there are plenty here that can make suggestions for it. But pure music, you have the influence of a pure Bible on a daily basis that maybe you don't crack open all that much. Right? But the benefit of virtuous things, I think we sometimes underrate pure friendships. You want to hang out with who you like instead of who's best for you. You know what I'm saying? Pure friendships, pure music, pure Bible. Spiritual things, not carnal things. You know, when Jesus Christ, there were a couple of occasions, once in Luke, where when Jesus Christ healed somebody, or when somebody walked up and touched him, that Jesus said that he felt virtue go from him and heal the person. What healed the person was virtue. Virtue is a pure thing. And I would just admonish that, you're told, let me just show you that, if I could. Look in 2 Corinthians chapter 7. 2 Corinthians 7, very interesting thing. We sometimes start at the beginning of a chapter and don't look at what the last thing that was said in the last chapter was. And so in 2 Corinthians chapter 7, you read in verse 1, "Having therefore these promises, dearly beloved, let us cleanse ourselves from all filthiness of the flesh and spirit." Now, I know that virtue is not used in the passage, but, you know, cleanse ourselves from all filthiness of the flesh and spirit. Well, the context of that starts in chapter 6, verse 14. "Be ye not unequally yoked together with unbelievers." It's talking about a virtuous fellowship. "For what fellowship hath righteousness with unrighteousness? What communion hath light with darkness? What concord hath Christ with Belial? What part hath he that believeth with an infidel?" I get fed up with listening to megachurch pastors and pastoresses tell us how pharisaical we are for not caring for their music, their lifestyle, their stinking cruddy Bibles. They treat us like legalists and Pharisees because we're interested in something purer than what they have. Well, the very context of 7:1 is 2 Corinthians chapter 6, verse 16, "And what agreement hath the temple of God with idols? For ye are the temple of the living God. As God said, I will dwell in them and walk in them, and I will be their God, and they shall be my people. Wherefore, come out from among them, and be ye separate, saith the Lord, and touch not the unclean thing." Don't even touch it. So how is it again that I am a Pharisee because I don't want my grandchildren boogie-woogieing to rock and roll? How is it that I'm, you know, a Pharisee because I really don't want to, you know, train the next generation to like Disney, which these days is about as rainbowish as you can get, or worse? It's worse, exactly. So how is it again that I'm a Pharisee, a legalist? Shouldn't we regard the benefits of virtuous things? How about this? One more and then I'm done. All right, Philippians chapter 4. Philippians chapter 4. All right, finally, brethren, verse 8. "Whatsoever things are true, whatsoever things are honest, whatsoever things are just, whatsoever things are pure, whatsoever things are lovely, whatsoever things are of good report, if there be any virtue, if there be any praise, think on these things." I mean, shouldn't your mind be occupied with virtuous thoughts as opposed to the stuff in this world? But five things regarding vagueness in the will of God, regarding the value of righteous culture, regarding the validity of waiting on the Lord, regarding the vainglory's sure shipwreck, and finally regarding the benefits of virtuous things. Let's pray. Well, Father, I pray that you might